you know, this true, natural, beautiful power inside of a human being. You know, storytelling is a great gift to humanity, and, you know, we don't practice it anywhere near enough. It's just a magnificent gift to us.
All right, John Young, thank you so much for joining us this morning here on KBOO. He will be in the area with this workshop, Music, Nature, and Storytelling. Coming up, you can get more information about that again at 8spdx.com. KBOO is also a co-sponsor of that event. You can find more information on the right side of our homepage at kboo.fm. John, thanks so much for being with us, and happy solstice to you, speaking of reconnecting with nature and looking at seasons and the year a little differently.
All right. Well, thanks for taking time with me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to share.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay. Take care.
And stay tuned for the rest of the incomparable radio zine and political perspectives here on KBOO, your community radio station.
It's 9:30. You're tuned to KBOO, KBOO Portland. Next up, we have the second part of Political Perspectives this morning, an excerpt from Radio EcoShock featuring a teleconference hosted by Daphne Wysham about how West Coast cities are leading us out of the fossil age, even as they struggle with constant demand for more pipelines and ports. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Reactions to the Paris Climate Agreement are all over the map. Unexpectedly, our correspondent Paul Beckwith wonders if it isn't a tipping point in human affairs. Before we talk with them, I want you to hear an extraordinary teleconference hosted by former Earthbeat radio host Daphne Wysham. We hear how West Coast cities are leading us out of the fossil age, even as they struggle with constant demand for more pipelines, more ports. I'm Alex Smith, with all that and more this week on Radio EcoShock. Just when things look bleak for the climate, we discover city mayors are way ahead of national leaders. Daphne Wysham leads this story. She's the former host of the syndicated radio program Earthbeat and now director of climate and energy program at the Center for Sustainable Economy from Portland, Oregon. Daphne, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
In a few minutes, we're going to hear from some West Coast progressive cities on a conference call you did. But first, tell us about the movement against any new infrastructure for fossil fuels.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've found since moving back out to the Pacific Northwest is that there's a very strong grassroots movement against some 27 fossil fuel export proposals that are on the books right now all across the Pacific Northwest that represent, by some studies, five times the carbon content of the Keystone XL pipeline annually. And so there's this rich grassroots resistance to all of these proposals. However, it's very time-consuming and exhausting because in some cases, as soon as you've defeated one proposal, another one comes down the pike. And in some cases, in the same towns and the same cities, over and over again, we have to rally the troops and get them out there to testify and so on. And one thing that we decided that we really needed in place was a more, not a defensive, an offensive posture. And so when Portland got a proposal for a propane export terminal, we rallied again. We got hundreds of people turning out at the hearing saying, no, we don't want this propane export terminal to be bringing mile-long trains down from Alberta filled with highly explosive propane to export to China. We don't want this in our town. And we succeeded in getting our mayor to turn around. And we decided after we got our mayor to reverse his initial support for this, that we really wanted to see once and for all no new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland. After all, it's one of the greenest cities in the country. It's the first to put in place the Climate Action Plan, the first to not only meet but exceed the Kyoto Protocol targets, got the highest bike ridership in the country, on and on. It just was a bad idea for Portland to have to be facing any new fossil fuel infrastructure projects. So again, we pushed our mayor and pushed the city council, and on November 12th, we got in place the strongest fossil fuel infrastructure policy that we know of in the country. Perhaps only Vancouver, BC is close to ours, and they're in Canada, obviously. But shortly thereafter, I decided, you know, if it's good for Portland, it should be good for all these other cities. After this passed, we developed a website, nonewffi.org, as in no new fossil fuel infrastructure. I managed to get endorsements from groups all over the country, including Indigenous Environmental Network, Winona LaDuke of Honor the Earth, Bill McKibben and others. And then we started pushing for mayors to endorse Mayor Hale's resolution and commit to doing similar, putting in place similar restrictions on fossil fuel infrastructure in their jurisdiction. Last count, I think there were 11 mayors and over 30 elected officials on the West Coast in a matter of days signed on to endorse this resolution. So now comes the tough work of making this binding law, which we will be doing over the coming year, and then taking the lessons that we learned from that practice to begin to share lessons learned with other cities up and down the West Coast and ideally all over North America.
Is there more news you want to share following your teleconference with civic leaders?
The biggest surprise to me was the mayor of Richmond, California, which is home to Chevron, the Chevron refinery that has sickened and killed, actually, I think, several of my family members who used to work in the region died of cancer as a result of that refinery. Quite a few people in the community, they have a very high cancer rate. And there's been a lot of great organizing in Richmond. And so it's very exciting that we now have the mayor of Richmond, California, on board this resolution pledging no new fossil fuel infrastructure and a just transition for the workers there.
Daphne, we need to know the websites where listeners can find out more about stopping the expansion of fossil fuels and finding better energy alternatives.
So exciting. You can listen to the audio from our press conference. And one of the people at our press conference was a mayor from Southern California who has put in place the first, what he calls a net zero carbon city in the country, where they're developing renewable, so much solar power that they're actually exporting it. He also happens to be the lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit taking on this gigantic methane leak that's happening right now in Southern California that represents 25% of all of California's methane emissions. So he's a very powerful speaker, and you can listen to him and Winona and Bill McKibben and others at nonewffi.org. We need your support. We'd love to get people endorsing our petition, organizations, businesses, and others. We need everybody on board this movement.
Good. And what's the website for the Center for Sustainable Economy?
It's just sustainable-economy.org, but you can also find it. We link to it at nonewffi.org.
We'll get that and scene.org, all of those links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Daphne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Let's hear some local leaders on this conference call against more fossil fuel infrastructure. Leave it in the ground. We begin with Vancouver, Canada, going fossil free. We'll hear from Winona LaDuke on her people's pipeline battle and get ready for some incredible news about poisoned waters in California, where one quarter of America's produce comes from, and better news, the first net zero city in the world. Here's Daphne Wysham introducing Andrea Reimer.
Andrea Reimer was appointed as Vancouver, BC's first permanent deputy mayor. She's been the council lead on the greenest city action plan since its inception in 2009. And in 2015, spearheaded the city's efforts to be the first major city in the Americas to commit to 100% renewable energy. Andrea Reimer, welcome to our conference call.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here today on behalf of our mayor, Gregor Robertson. So I was going to speak just a bit to some of the work that Vancouver's been doing. I know that we don't share the same national government, but we definitely share the same coastline and a lot of the same challenges that Portland does, the same geography, essentially, a lot of the same geoclimatic, and very similar cultures and histories that have informed the work that we're doing today. So it's exciting to be aligned with them on this initiative. So Vancouver did pass the first renewable energy strategy of any major city in the Americas back in November 2015. It commits the City of Vancouver to 100% renewable energy for electricity, heating, cooling, and transportation, so all fossil fuel burning would be banned as a result of replacement by renewable energy. So that renewable energy strategy builds on a pretty significant body of work we'd already been undertaking through our Greenest City Action Plan. So Greenest City was a commitment that we made in 2009 when we were first elected to be the greenest city in the world by the year 2020. At the time, we didn't even show up on the rankings. They don't rank every city in the world, so all we know was we were lower than the last ranked city, which was about number 500. Now, just last year, we were awarded fourth greenest city on Earth, so that's a pretty significant movement, and it's been a huge effort for us, not just on climate, but on water, on waste, on food, on green jobs, and just transition strategy. So that plan, when it was established, also set long-term targets that looked out to 2050, and one of those was an end to fossil fuels, and that's given us the mandate since 2009 to vigorously oppose any new fossil fuel infrastructure that is proposed to be in the City of Vancouver, although generally they tend to take the form of things coming through the City of Vancouver, seeking the ocean to go out somewhere in the world. Sort of an irony in Canada that you have this massive tar sands up in Alberta, and the last thing it would have to pass through to get out to the ocean and to market is through the City of Vancouver, which has this green aspiration. So we've been fighting the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is a proposal to increase tar sand export, tar sand bitumen exports through the West Coast ports by a sevenfold increase. In 2012, out of frustration with having to every single time a new proposal came forward, pass a motion, we passed an omnibus that we would oppose all new fossil fuel infrastructure. In 2013, we banned coal terminals, so it's taken completely out of our zoning and development bylaw. It's impossible to build one in the City of Vancouver. And then in 2015, you know, when you spend a lot of time fighting against things, it builds a lot of support to fight for something. And that's where the renewable energy strategy came in, that we really felt that rather than having to keep going talking about what we didn't want in the city, we really needed to get people mobilized, especially in the COP21 year, behind the vision of the future that they imagined was possible. So we passed that in early 2015. Our staff have been working with the community and experts and people around the world to build the strategy, which was formally adopted in November. It's bold and ambitious, but completely doable. It is one of the first motions I've ever passed at council where I thought, you know, maybe this is actually impossible. It turns out it's not at all. It's about saying, yes, this is where we're going, and then putting all of our human innovation and talent into figuring out how we are going to get there. When we passed our original motion at the beginning of the year, we were one of less than a dozen cities in the world that had passed policy to that effect. Now we are one of hundreds of cities, and we expect that growth will continue exponentially because none of us can do this alone. So exciting times to be partnering with other cities on this. Really excited to hear what the other cities on the call are doing.
Thank you, Andrea. I wanted to announce a very exciting new endorser of our ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure, which is the mayor of Richmond, California, home of the enormous Chevron oil refinery. Mayor Tom Butt signed on from Paris, France, just last night. We also got the endorsement of Mayor Kitty Piercy of Eugene. So the long list of endorsers is up on our website, which is nonewffi.org. You can sign on there and also see all of the elected officials that have signed on. Next up is Mayor Rex Harris. He is the mayor of Lancaster, California, and he's an attorney representing the thousands of families in Porter Ranch, California, who are being forced to live under a cloud of methane, benzene, and hydrosulfide gases as a result of an injection well blowout that is being called the BP of the West Coast. Some environmental groups claim that this one leak represents 25% of California's methane emissions annually, and it still remains uncapped. As mayor of Lancaster, California, he enacted the first ordinance requiring solar panels on all new construction. Lancaster will be the first net zero city in the world. Currently, all city-operated buildings in school are powered by solar. Thanks for joining us, Mayor Ferris.
first let me talk to you about the city of Lancaster, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on in Porter Ranch. About 8 years ago, the city of Lancaster made the decision to become the first net zero city in the country, if not the world. We will reach that goal within the next 8 months. What that means is we will be producing more energy from the sun than we use in the entire city. We were the first city to pass an ordinance that requires solar panels on every house. And what was most interesting about that is there was almost no pushback from it. And it was embraced by all of the citizens from what we can tell. And as a result of it, we're now, the builders in this city are now building net zero houses using batteries from BYD, which is a company in China. The thing we will be announcing in the next few months is a 500 megawatt storage facility that BYD from China will be building in our city. What's significant about that is that means there really isn't much need for more infrastructure. We now have the ability to store the alternative energy, which has always been the problem as to replacing fossil fuels with alternative energy, and it looks like we've conquered that now. The problem is obviously this requires a huge shift in people's business models that are going to be resisted and are being resisted. The necessity of dealing with the infrastructure that the fossil fuel industry is forcing upon us is becoming more and more apparent in California. Before the Porter Ranch blowout of the injection wells, what we discovered is that the water supply in the San Joaquin Valley that feeds 25% of our nation's food supply, grown food supply, comes from the San Joaquin Valley. And the aquifers appear to be poisoned. The cherry trees started to die. Now the almond trees are dying. And the testing shows that we're getting, in some cases, benzene levels of 1,000 times what's acceptable. All kinds of hydrocarbon poisons are in there. And that's because the oil industry has been injecting directly into the drinking water of California. The thing we should start recognizing is this industry has no responsibility whatsoever. They have captive agencies regulating them, and as a result, the impact they're having on the climate, the country, and the citizens is beyond comprehension. The Porter Ranch situation is an example of that. They used a 50-year-old well. It was drilled in 1954 to pump oil, and they used that as an injection well to store natural gas under high pressures. The inevitable happened, it blew, and now we have thousands of families living under this cloud with very little we can do about it. We're trying to relocate them. The gas company is resisting. This is Sempra Energies that's responsible for this. And we're going to have more and more of these situations develop as they take more and more risks in finding energy. I guess that pretty well sums it up.
That was Rex Paris, mayor of Lancaster, California, the first net zero city, on a conference call with Daphne Wisham against new fossil fuel infrastructure.
Winona LaDuke is a former vice presidential candidate and executive director of Honor the Earth. I'm going to turn it over to you now, Winona.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to call in. I'm from northern Minnesota, the White Earth Reservation, and we're in a situation where we are facing three big new oil pipelines that they proposed to put across our wild rice beds. Those pipelines will be carrying fracked oil from the Bakken and tar sands oil. You know, we are people that live this whole world. This is our whole world up here, and these pipelines are not necessary. Oil demand has diminished, and in the face of the stranded assets and liabilities, they will be for future generations. We're saying no new fossil fuel pipelines in the north. We're saying no new fossil fuel pipelines. And, you know, to be honest, probably like everyone else on this in this conference call, I'm not opposed to infrastructure. We're a country that has a D plus in infrastructure. We have crumbling bridges. We have gas mains that explode. We don't have many of our reservations don't even have basic infrastructure. So I'm all for infrastructure, but what we'd like is infrastructure which is for people, not for oil companies, and not a liability to all of us. So we're looking at the Enbridge pipelines, not the TransCanada. These are the Enbridge lines, and their goal is to get to Superior, the furthest inland port. And the people that are in between them are all the Ojibwe reservation.
This is Andrea Reimer from Vancouver.
Yeah.
Can I just add something to the earlier point?
Sure.
I mean, there's obviously a very compelling environmental case to stop burning fossil fuels, very compelling social case that Winona laid out. There's, I would argue, a moral case by virtue of the fact that someone gave us the future that is today. We have a responsibility to give a future to the next generation. But there's also an extremely compelling economic case to it. So If I was Mobil and I know that there's no future for fossil fuels on the planet, there's global treaty being signed that will continue to constrain and limit the burning of those fossil fuels. If there's no future for the thing your economy depends on, there's no future for your economy. So just at a straight economic level, I would be looking at that and thinking about what is the next thing we are going to be doing as a city. Vancouver, with the Greenest City Action Plan, our economy has grown by leaps and bounds, almost too fast, actually, to be socially sustainable. We will be by far the fastest growing economy in Canada over this next year because of the over-reliance of fossil fuels in other parts of the country. And even at that, continue to meet and exceed the goals that we set on green. So I think if you're charged with thinking about the future of your community, not just from a weather or climate standpoint, but from how the economy is going to work, you should be thinking about that transition right now.
This is Rex again from Lancaster. Okay, on a smaller scale, we could echo exactly what Vancouver is saying. We thought this was going to be an economic detriment to us, and we found just the opposite. Our people are paying less electricity charges. We're bringing in more industry that's clean industry. It's been nothing but pluses. And I think, I don't know what Vancouver expected, but we were expecting the opposite, and we're just pleasantly surprised.
There you go. National leaders are way behind the cities. My thanks to Daphne Weisham of the Center for Sustainable Economy. Be sure and check out and support the movement to stop more fossil fuel pipelines, ports, and development at the website nonewffi.org. Find a link to the full audio of this teleconference with more guests at nonewffi.org and in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Mainstream media tells you the Paris Climate Summit was a deal to save the ages. For a different take, we've reached regular Radio EcoShock contributor Paul Beckwith. He's the scientist studying and teaching climate science in Canada at the University of Ottawa. Paul was just in Paris, in the streets and in meeting halls, but now he's in Norway. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Alex.
What are your impressions and takeaways from the COP21 climate talks in Paris, December 2015?
I'm very encouraged with what I saw in Paris. It doesn't go far enough, we know that, but I think it really does get the ball rolling, something which the previous 20 COP did not do. And getting the ball rolling in Paris, you know, being a major, you know, European city, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes with diplomats, with negotiators, with policymakers in different countries. There seems to be a different atmosphere. There was some sense of the importance and the urgency. And I think it's because people's wallets all over the planet are starting to be affected a lot by climate change. It's becoming very important for economies and countries financially to take climate change seriously. You know, I don't think that the politicians and policymakers, most of them, are quite to speed on, you know, Arctic sea ice decline and the risk of methane coming up. But they are tying the extreme weather event that we're seeing around the world to climate change. So they're recognizing that, hey, we've only had a degree of warming in the planet and we're already getting these severe events. And you have people like in the Stern report saying that a certain percentage of global GDP will be required to fight climate change. And the longer we leave it, the worse it becomes. And him saying that he thinks he underestimated the rate at which climate change was occurring and things like that. I was very encouraged by all of this.
But James Hansen was not. He says this voluntary approach has never worked before, so why would it work now? I just wonder, it took us, Paul, about 25 years to take climate change seriously, and I don't see tools built into this agreement to actually do very much. Am I wrong on that?
Well, James Hansen would be unhappy with anything less than a global fee on carbon, a fee and dividend approach to carbon on a global basis. So if the countries agreed, okay, we'll put a fee on carbon of, say, you know, start off at $10 or $20, $30 a ton, and increase it every few years after reevaluation and have a dividend being returned back to the people, which is what the group Citizens Climate Lobby, you know, many people in the public have joined this group, and this is what they've been pushing. And I think most economists that actually study the problem recognize that's the best thing to do. So we haven't seen that yet. But the ball has started to roll. Like, people in finance are talking about climate change being a serious issue. If listeners haven't seen the speech a couple of days before the end of COP by John Kerry talking about how the military is recognizing the risks and climate change is the most important, the most severe issue that the world has to face. And you have, of course, the Pope saying the same thing. You have other people saying the same thing, scientists saying the same thing. So I think probably my expectations of what could happen in Paris are a lot lower than Hansen's. Like I say, I think Hansen is seeing black and white, you know, no carbon fee and dividend, therefore failure of the conference. What I'm seeing is the global ball is starting to roll down the hill and it will only pick up speed. Like, to give you an idea, the EU preparation for the Paris conference, it involved 90,000 diplomats in numerous countries in the EU and also outside the EU. So there's tremendous diplomatic momentum that will occur after Paris. I mean, Paris is not the be-all and end-all. It just got the talks going and it got some sort of agreement. And it's like, we may look back. You never know when there's a tipping point at when it happens, generally. It's only looking in the rearview mirror that you see that. And so what's happening coming up this year is climate change is definitely on the agenda for all 2016 multilateral events, because we have the World Economic Forum coming up in 2016. We have a G7 meeting in 2016. We have a G20 meeting, and there's follow-up meetings to Paris, and the UN is holding numerous meetings, and there's energy strategy and diplomacy and bilateral partnerships with China, Latin America, and the U.S. There's all these things going on, and all of these things will now go on given that Paris has happened and that agreements have started. So I think that we'll see the ball rolling faster and faster, especially if we are undergoing abrupt climate change, which I've been saying that we have for quite a while. Then I think we'll start seeing these abrupt changes in human response. I've talked about the human tipping point. One cannot say that it's occurred yet, but I think maybe 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we'll be able to say that it did occur if it does in fact occur. So, you know, Paris is only the beginning. It's not the end, but we're certainly in a much better position globally on policy and so on than we were 3 weeks ago, say, before the Paris meeting, I would argue.
So is this agreement giant and complex, or are there layers in it that we should understand? Is there anything you'd like to talk about what was actually agreed on?
The Conference of Parties, it involves all the parties of the world, and the parties are the different countries. So there were 196 or something. There were, you know, maybe 4 or 5 or something like that that weren't involved, you know, small countries or for whatever reason, but they had these intended nationally determined contributions. So this is what they say they're trying to achieve. But I mean, what I understand is, you know, if a country opts out of what they're saying they can do, if they're not making an honest effort to try it, then I think that country will be hurt. Like, their global standing will be hurt. They'll kind of be ridiculed by the other countries. Their economies will suffer. They're developing countries, for example. There's tremendous money that will be going into climate finance before 2020. Like, there's, I saw the number 100 billion, and then, I mean, in Kerry's speech, he was talking about 80 billion from the U.S. or something, and he said that was going to be doubled. I mean, look, how many other COPs have had the Mark Carneys of the world debating with Michael Bloomberg of the world about climate and investment, and with Tom Steyer sitting in the front row, and, you know, and Bill Gates and multi-billionaires, Musk and other people, you know, attending the conference, taking a big role, attending the sessions on investment and climate change, you know, each going up and saying things. Watch the facial expressions, watch what the reaction, you know, how people are speaking, like Kerry and Gates and Musk and others when they're up. And if you can read people, it seems that these people are really starting to get concerned about the rapid changes that are happening, because the changes that we're observing in the climate system are invariably happening much faster with much more serious implications than the IPCC documents would tend to show. I don't know for sure. I mean, I haven't been to all of the COPs. I mean, I went to Lima last year, and Paris is my second one. And judging from the meetings that were occurring in Paris, it was like night and day compared to Lima. It seems that people are getting a lot more serious about dealing with the issue. And I think there's only one reason for that, and that is because we're undergoing abrupt climate change and the climate system is going to hell, and we're seeing all of the, you know, threats to food supply. We're seeing droughts places. We're seeing more and more cities succumbing to the climate casino, the negative aspects of the climate casino, like being flooded out or something. There's an enormous economic impact on infrastructure, and it's happening now. It's not happening 20 years or 50 years or 100 years in the future. It's not happening with our grandkids. It's happening right now.
And that was an excerpt from Radio EcoShock with host Alex Smith. He was speaking with Radio EcoShock correspondent Paul Beckwith about the Paris climate talks. You can hear the whole interview plus a different response from Lindsay Allen by going to radioecoshock.org and clicking on the program called Climate Hope and Tragedy. That's Radio EcoShock, Climate Hope and Tragedy. And next we're going to go on to Flashpoints, where the topic today is homeless, hungry, and under attack. All this happening on KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, and KBOO.FM on the internet. We're going to hear one announcement, and then we'll get right to Flashpoints. Thanks for tuning in today. By the way, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, please go to KBOO.FM and click on Donate Today to join us.
Tune in the fourth Monday of each month at 11:30 a.m. to Voices for the Animals.